Welcome, everybody, to the first lecture in our series, Religion, Globalization, and Dialogue, sponsored by the McGill Center for Research on Religion. I was told last year that I didn't introduce myself until the fourth meeting, so I figure I should probably do that the first time this year around. I'm Torrence Kirby, and I'm actually the director of the center. And it's my pleasure to, well, first of all, to introduce the series as a whole, which I'd like to do, and also to introduce our guest speaker. We are actually sharing a mic, so he's going to be standing here beside me. The series, Religion, Globalization, and Dialogue, was a theme that was suggested to us through McGill's coming to be affiliated with the Tony Blair Faith Foundation. And through our connection with that initiative, if you've never heard of this before, you might be interested to look it up on the web. It's easily found. You can Google it. They have a number of programs, quite an amazingly diverse set of programs, including an affiliation with various universities around the globe. I had the opportunity to take part in a teleconference call where we had participants from Western Australia, Singapore, Beijing, Mexico City, New Haven, Connecticut, Montreal, of course, and England. And so there are, so far, I think about 8 or 9 universities participating in this initiative. All of them are pursuing the theme, in fact, which we're introducing to you tonight, Religion and Globalization. And I believe I'm at liberty now to actually announce to you that we will have a visit from Tony Blair at some point in November. And I'm hoping that he will come and say hello to you in this series. I want to just say a few things now about the series as a whole, just to introduce what we're attempting in this lecture series. Religious persuasion possesses an almost unparalleled power to play both a positive and a negative role in the pursuit of political and social harmony in today's increasingly integrated global community. While those who seek to employ religion in order to promote conflict may be few in number, they are nevertheless organized and are often extremely effective in achieving their aims. Under current conditions of globalization, it has never been more necessary to ensure that those who seek peace and harmony among the world's major religions are also well organized and well equipped, both intellectually and practically, to confront any threat or disruption to our collective peace and order. What are the implications of religious diversity for the promotion of human rights? This is a question we'll be asking ourselves in this series. Does globalization presage perhaps a syncretistic convergence of the world religions, or possibly even the end of religion as hitherto understood? To what extent are the particular and positive requirements of religious faith and commitment reconcilable with the universalizing tendencies of a globalized economy and a globalized community? According to Article 18 of the UN Declaration of Human Rights, 1948, everyone has the right to freedom of thought, conscience, and religion. This right includes freedom to change religion or belief, and freedom either alone or in community with others, and in public or private, to manifest religion or belief in teaching, practice, worship, and observance. That's the UN Declaration. To what extent might this article be consistent with the core tenets of the world's major religions? Does the universalizing premise of globalization contain within it perhaps a seed of secularization? Are religious rights reconcilable with traditional pre-modern or perhaps even post-modern communitarian claims of these religious identities? Indeed, one might ask, is meaningful interfaith, interreligious dialogue possible under the conditions of globalization? And if so, what are the appropriate forms for promoting this conversation And that is what we're here for, is for that conversation. So it's to initiate our series. I'm very grateful to Professor Jeffrey Haynes, who has come all the way across the Atlantic. He came kick off this set of lectures from London, and where he is professor in the London Metropolitan University, which is, I understand, a combination of the Guildhall University and the University of North London. The two universities were put together. And Professor Haynes is a Guildhall man, am I right?
Indeed, yes, yes, that's right.
Professor Haynes is specialty is religion and politics. He's recognized as an international authority in five distinct areas: religion and international relations, religion and politics, democracy and democratization, development, as well as comparative politics and globalization. He has written 26 books. An amazing number of journal articles, and numbering over 100, and these include a lengthy discussion paper that he presented to the Geneva-based United Nations Research Institute for Social Development on Religion, Fundamentalism, and Identity, A Global Perspective. Among his recent books are Religion and Politics in Europe, the Middle East, and North Africa, and an Introduction to Religion and International Relations, as well as a book titled Comparative Politics in a Globalizing World. So I think you can tell from that list of titles why we invited Professor Haynes to come and kick off this series. So please join me in welcoming Professor Haynes.
Well, thanks very much, everybody, for coming here this evening. Thanks for sitting in this rather appropriate room. Thanks to, especially I think, to Professor Kirby for that very generous introduction, and of course for actually inviting me over to Canada to talk to you. I'm very pleased and actually honoured to be starting the series of talks, and as I just mentioned to Professor Kirby, the good thing about this is that you won't have heard it before in this series, so anything I say, you won't be able to say, oh, we heard that last week, so that's one good thing. I should just add, I think, that I'm not connected to the Tony Blair Faith Foundation. It's just really a coincidence that I'm here in that context. So in case anyone was thinking I was a representative of that foundation or indeed of Tony Blair himself, I'm not. Okay, well, the title is Religions and Global Politics, and that's a title which is very general, and as you will hear, much of what I have to say is very general, because I should be talking about some very big issues which I think are contoured by the times we live in. So rather than go into the minutiae of different countries or indeed different religious faiths, my aim is to try to present something which is an overview of major events over the recent past and at the present time, especially to try to assess how and why religion is now a factor in global politics. I won't come up with anything very conclusive, but I do want to do a sort of a tour of the issues, and I hope to be thought-provoking. This is certainly an intention. Starting point for this issue, I think, is something which we're aware of, but it's still quite surprising. And this is what's been called the return of religion to the public realm, the return of religion to both the domestic public realm and to the international public realm. Those of you who have long memories will recall that not so long ago there was a strong sense that religion was fading away, that something called modernization almost inevitably, certainly in the West at least, implied a fading away of religion as a public motivation for action. I've got three quotations on the screen which happen to be from the 1990s. Well, in a sense, not by chance are they from the 1990s, because it's the 1990s when it became emphatically clear that religion was a new factor of concern. Of course, as you will know, religion has long been an issue of both social and political consequence. But in international politics, or in global politics, religion has not had that particular position for a long time, as I shall mention in a moment. There's talk of what George Weigel has called an unsecularization of the world, which is a profound thing because it would imply a reversal of a trend towards secularization, which was synonymous with this notion of modernization for decades, for even perhaps for centuries. Second quotation is from a British journalist called Martin Woollacott, who writes for a newspaper called The Guardian, and he said, "Anybody who had predicted 30 years ago that the 20th century would end with the resurgence of religion, with great new cathedrals, mosques and temples rising up, with the symbols and songs of faith everywhere apparent, would in most circles have been derided." He's writing this 15 years ago, and he's referring back to the 1960s, therefore. And I think it captures quite well the sense of surprise which attended the return of religion to the public realm. And then finally, Samuel Huntington, the recently deceased Harvard professor, who is most famous in some people's eyes for this notion of clash of civilizations, wrote in 1996 that in the modern world, religion is central, perhaps the central force that motivates and mobilizes people. And that's a surprise. It's a surprise to me. I'm a social scientist, and my own training is in international relations. 30 years ago, when I was undertaking my undergraduate studies in international relations, the word religion never crossed my lips. The word religion was never talked about in theories of international behaviour. We certainly wouldn't overlook it now, I think. But it's certainly the case, and I just want to sort of start with this as a way of emphasising how things have changed. During much of the 20th century, modernity was understood necessarily to comprise secularisation. Secularisation is one of these terms with lots of meanings, but I'm using it in the sense of a gradual yet definitive withdrawal of religion from the public realm, as I call it. Religion becomes less and less important in making public decisions by government and others. So by the last decade of the 20th century, there was growing acceptance that modernization equals secularization was not the end of the story, as I referred to the quotations from the three figures on the first slide. Religion then had returned from privatization to the public realm. Religious privatization is the notion that religion moves away from the public realm to become a private, spiritual, individual thing rather than a motivator of collective action. Because of associated values, beliefs and norms, religion is now widely regarded as a key component in many contemporary conflicts and a potential source of their resolution. So when we think about this issue of religion in global politics, we would not take very long to get onto the idea that religion is often involved in conflicts. Religion is potentially a source of conflicts. And it's this, perhaps, which animates many of the discussions about the public role of religion in both domestic and international contexts. So to understand the current role of religion in global politics, we can't rely on a single elegant theoretical model that would enable us to deal adequately with all such cases. Such a theory doesn't exist. It may be a question of time. It may be that somebody will come up with an elegant, simple theory in due course, and we will all go, aha, that's how we explain religion in global politics. But I doubt it. And the reason I doubt it is because the factors involved, I think, are too diverse, even fragmented, to actually come up with a theory, a simple, persuasive theory that explains the actions. And I hope that by the end of the talk, you will agree with me. We've got two very big terms here, religion and globalization, and I'm not going to go down the road of trying to define religion. Many of you will know that when it comes to defining religion, there's more than a controversy. There is a simple lack of agreement as to what religion is. So I'm not going to try and define religion, but I am going to try to define globalization because it's It's something which is more definable for many people than religion is. And it may be a coincidence, it may not be a coincidence, that the return of religion has coincided with the onset of this phase of globalization. It's a hypothesis that the two are connected. We certainly can't say definitively that they are. But any coincidence of that nature, I think, requires investigation. So what I should call current globalization is the phase of globalization which has occurred since the 1980s. It's the same period as the return of religion. Current globalization is an historically unprecedented era of global change, characterized by swift urbanization, for some rapid industrialization, environmental damage, and significant technological, economic, and political changes. Revolutionary in their impact. And as everyone in the room knows, we are living through these major, unprecedented changes, and it would take a very brave person to say where it's going to end. Globalization undermines traditional value systems, leading to increased uncertainty, instability, and insecurity. It's certainly the case that with the outcome of the 2008 economic recession, we have greater uncertainty, instability, insecurity. But I think that globalization, in a wider sense, leads to those outcomes as well. So where does religion come into all this? Because I'm not going to be claiming that religion has taken or resumed a central position in international relations. It wouldn't be the case. It would be impossible to justify that particular position. But on the other hand, religion has manifested itself at the global level in many ways in recent years, whether it be conflict, whether it be cooperation. But the conundrum is, how does religion do this? Why is religion influential? We're used to seeing influence expressed in global politics by governments, by powerful entities that can bring many kinds of resources to try to deal with problems. What has religion got to seek to influence outcomes? It doesn't have the same kind of resources that governments do. It doesn't have the same kind of resources that multinational corporations do. It doesn't have the same kinds of resources that regional organizations do. So what does religion have to make it a player in global politics? I'm going to suggest to you that religion has something called soft power, something which allows religion to be influential in ways which are not necessarily unprecedented, but in ways which have not generally been of major import to global politics in recent years. I just need to very briefly refer to a little bit of history here, because religion used to be a major player in global politics. 400 years ago or more, religion was the key player in global politics. Since that time, of course, the international state system has emerged, and the map of the world is filled with governments ruling over specific territories. We know that's how the world looks. And in that particular context, religion doesn't really fit in very well, because a usual map of the world expresses power very clearly. Power lies in territories ruled over by governments. We can see it clearly. The territory of X, the territory of Y, that's how international relations or global politics works. But before that era of international relations or global politics, religion was far and away the most influential player in global politics. But it became a problem. Peace, prosperity, cooperation were difficult to achieve owing to religious conflicts, especially in Europe, between different Christian groups. And then religion was connected to what I call hard power. Religious power was very often connected to hard power. Hard power is military and or economic power. Soft power is the power of ideas. It's the power of persuasion. It's the power to influence people to behave in certain ways because they want to do so, rather than they're compelled to do so. So I'm suggesting to you that religion is a major source of global soft power today. Globalization helps to make that power stronger and clearer by spreading ideas, norms, and values. Power is something which is much easier to understand when we can see hard power. We can see the power of an army. We can see the power of money. Power of ideas is much harder, I think, to measure. But I'm suggesting that when we think about religion in global politics, it's the power of ideas which gives religion influence. The US international relations specialist Joseph Nye coined the term soft power 20 years ago. He was talking about the influence of the United States in global politics and making the useful point that US power was not only dependent upon its hard power, its military and economic capacity, but also dependent on the fact that at the time, 20 years ago, America was regarded by people around the world from different cultures as something to emulate, a country to... We want to be like the Americans. This gave the US a clout and a capacity in global politics, which Nye characterized as soft power. The US, of course, did have hard power as well, but it had this soft power, something which enabled it to achieve its objectives without necessarily resorting to the use of hard power. What's power? Well, power for me is the ability to influence others to get them to do what you want. There's three ways to do this. This is Joseph Nye's argument. I'm just blatantly stealing his ideas here. Three ways to do this. Threaten with sticks, pay with carrots, or attract so those to be influenced want what you want. You can threaten with sticks, in other words, you can use force or the threat of force. You can pay with carrots, you can bribe, reward with money. Or, with soft power, you can attract. You can get people to act in certain ways because they want to emulate you, because they want to be like you, because they want to follow you. Compulsion is not involved. Compulsion is involved with hard power. Religion, then, has soft power which enables religion, this thing I'm calling religion, to be influential in global politics. If you can get others to be attracted to want what you want, it costs less than using carrots and or sticks. Soft power is economical. It means that you can achieve outcomes without too much outlay of resources. In short, then, soft power is the ability to get what you want through attraction rather than coercion or payments, and religious soft power can be an important component of power, just like hard material resources. And let me give you an example. You'd be thinking, well, what exactly do I mean? Well, let me clarify. 20 years ago, when the Soviet Union collapsed, this followed a long period of repression of both national aspirations and religious aspirations in the communist countries of Eastern Europe. And the Soviet Union was a very powerful, very clear exponent of hard power. Soviet power was equal to the hard power that the Soviet Union could apply to its goals in foreign policy and domestic policy. And then, out of the blue, 20 years ago or more, suddenly that Soviet power fell away. We were amazed, we were perplexed, we couldn't understand what was happening. How could this country that for 40, 50, 60 years had been a global power of preeminence, how could it suddenly fall away? How could it suddenly collapse? Many people would trace that collapse to what occurred in Poland in the mid-80s, when the then Polish Pope John Paul II traveled for the second time to Poland. The Polish government wasn't keen on him coming, but it would have been too much of a step to deny his entry. It became a focal point of Polish aspirations for freedom from the Soviet Union. But not just nationalist aspirations, but aspiration based on religion. 95% of Poles are Roman Catholics. The Polish Pope in Poland was a symbol of a desire for religious rejuvenation, which overlapped with the desire for Polish national aspirations too. And it's often said that after Mikhail Gorbachev and Ronald Reagan, John Paul II did more to bring down communism than anybody else. Well, Ronald Reagan talked about democracy and human rights. Mikhail Gorbachev talked about reforming communism to give it a human face. John Paul II talked about the power of religion to free people. And I'm suggesting to you that this is a very good example of just soft power in action. The spark that was lit in Poland by John Paul II spread like wildfire to the rest of Eastern Europe. It wasn't necessarily religion that did it. I mean, many of the communist countries in Eastern Europe were, and still are as a matter of fact, very secular indeed. But it was the power of religion in Poland which began a process which, as everyone in the room knows, led to a dramatic, unprecedented change in global politics over a very brief period of time. Now it's fashionable to talk about how the US won the Cold War. But my recollection of the time was that the US didn't win the Cold War, the Soviet Union lost the Cold War because the Soviet Union was incapable of keeping going a system which in part denied the aspirations of people to have religious freedoms. Another example of religious soft power you might find controversial, it's the power of groups like Al-Qaeda to achieve success, to gain followers. How do they do it? They do it by a similar kind of expression of religious goals, encouraging people to join them through this seeking of religious goals. Now, it may be that Al-Qaeda's religious goals are not what anybody else here would see as a true religious goal, but it's certainly clear that the ability of Al-Qaeda to attract followers is linked, in part at least, by the power of the goals that it seeks to achieve, which it links to religion, even if it's a form of religion which most of us would find abhorrent. Another example might be in India, the power of Hindutva, Hindu nationalism, to achieve political success is linked to another form of religious soft power, where Hinduism as a cultural and religious entity is seen as a persuasive way to encourage people to join a certain political grouping. I could go on with examples, and you may want to talk to me about that, but it's my claim that religious soft power is something which helps us to understand the position of religion in global politics now. For the very obvious reason, religion doesn't have hard power. After World War II, you will have heard this story, but bear with me. After World War II, the then ruler of the Soviet Union, Joseph Stalin, was apparently asked, what role should the Roman Catholic Church have in the rebuilding of Europe? And Stalin's supposed to have said, how many divisions does the Pope have? What he meant by that was, how much military hardware, how many soldiers, how many tanks does the Pope have? And of course, the answer was none whatsoever. But, of course, it turned out that Stalin was wrong to see the world in that way, because all the tanks and hard power of the Soviet Union wasn't sufficient to deny changes at the end of the 1980s. I'm suggesting that religious soft power works via ideas, experiences, and practices. And I want to say a little bit about those three things. Religious ideas help explain the world. They help define ethical life and influence socio-political worldviews. I mean, this is me coming from a social scientific background. Traditionally, religious ideas focus on a particular community. We think of religion as a global entity, but religion, of course, has very much been localized. Religious practices tend to be localized under the rubric of a defined tradition. Religion is often different from place to place, even though it's the same brand of religion. Religious ideas focus on a particular community, what Peter Berger has called the sacred canopy, enabling believers to make sense of and come to terms with the world. Globalization helps to slash holes in that sacred canopy. Once people begin to be aware of alternative ways of seeing the world, not necessarily religious alternatives, but just alternative ways of seeing the world as a result of globalization, and religious ideas are almost certainly bound to change, to develop, to go from one thing to another. And it's certainly the case that there's anti-globalization reactions from religious protest movements which seek to revive or inaugurate localized practices. There's a sense of defending religious communities from the onslaught of globalization. An example I'm mentioning to you here is that of Orthodox Jews in Israel, who are very involved in lobbying against allowing shopping on the Shabbat, on the Jewish holy day, which is seen by them as a clear manifestation of the encroachment of globalization into their world. This is what they do in Europe, this is what they do in America, we don't want it here in Israel. So religious ideas tend to be affected very strongly by globalization. It's not clear how they will be affected, but it seems clear that they will be affected in various ways. Religious experiences, well, dynamic and dialectic connection between globalization and religion can lead to new experiences. Globalization can lead to increased self-reflection as a result of increased cultural, religious and social interactions between peoples. Can create or deepen political tension. Religious belonging is identity forming and becomes more important, while at the same time identity may be changing. So how we experience globalization in a religious sense can help to lead to experiences which in turn help to change how religion is expressed. An example I want to mention here is that Islamists may regard globalization as a specific Western hegemonic tool seeking to spread ideas, including alien ideas about gender relations, secularization, and democratization. It's a way of saying then that globalization leads to experiences which people respond to. Religious people may respond in many ways. Some religious people respond in ways which makes them want to fight against that what they see, the encroachment of alien ideas as a result of globalization. And then thirdly, religious practices. Religious practices are often intimately connected to specific cultures. It doesn't imply that they're necessarily static, but in an unglobalized world, religion tends to be more static, or at least change comes slowly. Globalization encourages diversity. One of the major trends of the last years, I referred at the beginning to this notion of an unsecularization of the world. That can mean many things. It can mean that people are turning to religion in greater numbers than before. But I think it really reflects the fact that people are turning to a wider variety of religions than ever before. There is a great array of religions available to people. Globalization brings this to people's attention in ways which it didn't do in the past. It encourages a diversity of religious practices. And think, for example, of religious fragmentation in Latin America and Africa, where the established mainline religions are finding themselves having to adapt to and deal with demands by ordinary people for different religious experiences, whether it be Catholicism or Anglicanism or other traditional Christian expressions of faith. They're now under threat like never before from a wide variety of new forms of religious practice. So religion becomes more dynamic, developing as a result of encounters. But if this unsecularization of the world means anything, I think it means the fact that people are now more religiously interested than before, but less willing to stay with their traditional religious faith than ever before. It also implies then that religious practices will differ even within the same religious tradition. And so, for example, various versions of the same religious tradition encompassing people with different practices. Think in the world of Islam of the differences between Al-Qaeda on the one hand and the Gulen movement. Fethullah Gulen is a Turkish scholar and theologian who has developed a form of Islam which is highly tolerant, highly willing to engage with and cooperate with other religious faiths. It's a million miles away from the extremist hatred of Al-Qaeda, but this is under the same rubric, Islam. So I'm suggesting that religious practices, as a result of globalization, tend to diversify and fragment. What this leads me to then is that it's very difficult to say with certainty that what we are going to see is more cooperation or more conflict. There is a real mixture of outcomes which we are definitely seeing and experiencing. I think the fact, however, is that conflict gets headlines. Conflict is much more newsworthy. We're much more aware of conflict. This is not to make a new point, but it's certainly the case that media thrives on conflict. Cooperation is good, but it's not newsworthy. So I'm suggesting that we tend to see more conflict when it comes to religion, largely because conflict is better represented in the media than is cooperation. But once again, the question would be, where does globalization fit in here? Because if we are seeing conflict and it's linked to religion, why? Is it just that it's better reported now? I think not. I think there is something else to explain it. And much conflict involving religion occurs in the developing world. I mean, it's certainly the case that the developing world is 80% of the world anyway. So statistically, we would expect to see conflict there. But it's also the case that this is these are the regions of the world where globalization has had such an emphatic, yet often quite negative impact. It's led to job losses, environmental degradation perhaps. It's led to an undermining of traditional ways of life, which are unsettling. It doesn't necessarily mean that conflict follows, but I shall suggest that one of the reasons why we tend to see more conflict at the global level involving religion is linked to this sense that globalization is undermining stability and security, not just in the developing world, but primarily in the developing world. So a positive view of religious soft power emphasizes enhanced opportunities for positive religious involvement in various global issues. Think, for example, of the Millennium Development Goals, which you will all have heard of here in this room, no doubt, inaugurated in year 2000, to be delivered by 2015. We're two-thirds of the way there. Not two-thirds of the way there in terms of success. The reason I'm mentioning them is the Millennium Development Goals were very heavily linked to bringing religion into the development framework for the first time. So there's a real sense that religion can help lead to beneficial outcomes, enhance cooperation for clear goals. International development then, human rights, conflict resolution, peace building, under the rubric enhanced global dialogue. All we have to do is talk to each other and we'll get cooperation. I don't think it's that simple, of course, but global dialogue is a way to achieve cooperation. This is a positive view of religious soft power. A negative view, sadly, emphasizes conflict. For example, the Clash of Civilizations linked to the Harvard IR specialist Samuel Huntington. So it's a bit like a kaleidoscope. We look at the world, we see cooperation. We turn the kaleidoscope, we see conflict. Religion's involved in both of those things. So it seems to be clear that religion is a rather plastic player in global politics, and its impact can be for good or for bad. It certainly isn't the case that it's one or the other, I think. I just wanted to mention this speech by Kofi Annan when he won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2001, former UN Secretary General, of course. He's pointing very much to this notion of the ambivalence of the sacred, the idea that religion has within it seeds of cooperation and seeds of conflict. He says, and this is, I'm quoting Kofi Annan here, "Each of us has the right to take pride in our particular faith or heritage, but the notion that what is ours is necessarily in conflict with what is theirs is both false and dangerous. It has resulted in endless enmity and conflict, leading men to commit the greatest of crimes in the name of a higher power." He's referring explicitly to religion here. "It need not be so. People of different religions and cultures live side by side in almost every part of the world, and most of us have overlapping identities which unite us with very different groups." It's a way of saying that because my neighbour is not of my religious persuasion, it doesn't mean I have to be antagonistic to him or her. It means that we share humanity in lots of other ways. Religion is just one facet of that. We can love what we are without hating what and who we are not. We can thrive in our own tradition even as we learn from others and come to respect their teachings. It's pointing to the notion that tolerance is a key component of progress when it comes to religious dialogue. But as you will know, tolerance is an easy word to say, but a difficult one to actually express in many real-world contexts. So some people then return to religion as a way of dealing with associated existential angst linked to globalization. It's not the only reason people felt insecure and unstable before globalization. They will feel insecure and unstable after globalization. But globalization particularly focuses those concerns because of the rapid sense that everything is changing way faster than we'd like and much beyond what we can control. I think this is the thing about globalization. We can see the benefits of it. We can see the wider range of goods in the shops. We can think about foreign trips much more than we could in the past. We can see a whole range of things which are good about globalization. But we can see a whole range of things which are perhaps not so good about globalization too. And this is us in the West. This is us in the rich West. It can be a lot more troubling to people in other parts of the world that haven't got the opportunities that we have. So many find in religion comfort, serenity, stability, and a spiritual uplifting. But that can lead to new or renewed feelings of identity, providing people with meaning and purpose, but it can also lead to greater intolerance and conflict. I am a proud follower of religion X, therefore you as a follower of religion Y are not as good as me, because you have a different way of seeing the world, and it's up to me to convince you to see the world like I do. This is not, of course, a blanket condemnation of religious people at all, but it is to say that religion, enhanced sense of religious identity, can and does lead to conflict. And three examples. Some religious fundamentalists have a view of the world which is intolerance personified. Religious terrorism speaks for itself. It's in the very epitome of intolerance. And this notion of clash of civilizations heightens the idea that differences between groups are more significant, much more significant than what they share. I mean, these are not the only forms of conflict, and they don't only involve religion, but they're expressions of how conflict can be expressed with a religious component. It's not to say that this is new necessarily, but it's probably the case that religion has not been expressed in this way to the extent that it is now in the past. So then religion is often implicated in both domestic and international conflicts. This is in part because religious conviction may contain with it various factors which can undermine chances of cooperation and peace. And there's four sources of danger, I think. Religion is focused on the absolute and unconditional, and as a result can adopt totalitarian characteristics. The monotheistic religions, Christianity, Islam and Judaism, may have a special difficulty trying to distinguish between, on the one hand, claims of the absolutely divine, and on the other, the traditions and history of human existence. In other words, how can we be certain that God thinks in that way rather than another way? We can only interpret this from holy books, let's say. And if the certainty that God wishes one form of action and not another one becomes predominant, this can lead to a major sense of intolerance to other people expressing different sets of ideas. If claiming both absolute and exclusive felicity, religious convictions can lead to intolerance, overzealous proselytization, and religious fragmentation. Can also be hostile to both pluralism and liberal democracy, which I guess many of us would see as major desirable goals to develop and to continue with. Religion can increase aggressiveness and the willingness to use violence, Added symbolic value can be an aspect of religious conviction deriving from profane motivation and aims to become holy objectives. There seems to have been a tendency towards seeking objectives in some religious faith which become a zero-sum game. The achievement of them must take priority and no undermining of that achievement can be allowed. Religious leaders may seek to legitimize abuses of power and violation of human rights in the name of religious zeal. Religious leaders are nearly always men, and as a result, there can also be specific gender-based human rights concerns. Now, I don't want you to think that this is a kind of a list of condemnation. This is one side of the story. This is the conflict side of the story. This is an explanation as to why religion can be seen in that way. I'm not claiming that this is what religion always does. I'm just claiming that sometimes this is what religion can be perceived to do. It links into this notion of exclusive accounts of the nature of reality. Concerns are especially problematic when they relate to exclusivist truth claims, that is, when religious people accept only their own religious beliefs as true beliefs. And of course, most religious people are not like that, but some are. Examples include religions of the book, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, because each claims authority that emanates principally from their sacred texts. I mean, the fact that their sacred texts have a lot in common doesn't necessarily mean that they will see eye to eye about things. Exclusivist truth claims are a serious and continuous challenge to religious toleration and diversity, essential to peaceful coexistence in our globalized world, as they make conflict more likely and peace less likely. Okay, religion and peace then. I want to get onto the other side of the coin. Most religious traditions have core beliefs that theoretically can help lead to a peaceful multicultural world. It's a cliche or even a truism that religious faiths tend to share lots of common ground. They tend to have a view of the world which expresses similar kinds of ideas. Thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not steal, etc. For example, Christianity features the notion of non-violence. Most, if not all, religious traditions, certainly the world religions, have a very core idea about the desirability of non-violence. No religions that I'm aware of, certainly none of the world religions, express the idea that violence is a desirable way to achieve objectives. Jesus insisted that all people are children of God and that the test of one's relationship with God is whether one loves one's enemies and brings good news to the world. As St. Paul said, there is no Jew or Greek, servant or free, male or female, because you're all one in Jesus. It's an effective way of saying that we're all the same. We may be different in terms of race, ethnicity, or whatever, but as human beings, we share goals, concerns, fears, they're the same the world over. Religious faith is something that can bring people together rather than diversify them. Overall, then, we can note the ambivalence of the sacred when it comes to conflict, conflict limitation, conflict resolution, and peace building. I'm certainly suggesting that what we do see at the current time is expressions of religious soft power which can be seen as either pro-conflict or pro-peace. And it's, to put it like that makes it sound as though it's a kind of a battle between two competing trends. But in a generalization, in a summary, which is what I'm trying to do, that's how we can, I think, approach the idea of understanding how religion plays out in global politics at the current time. There seems to be evidence for both views, the conflict view, the cooperation view. Well, I've talked about the post-1989 world, and I think that the further away we get from that period, still only 20 years ago, but seems like a long time ago, given how much has gone on since then. It's not only to do with globalisation, of course, but it's to do with changes which can broadly be associated with globalisation. That 20 years ago period, 1989, 1990, when the Soviet Union collapsed and the world changed dramatically and fundamentally, was for me one of the most epochal periods of human history. I think that's how it will be seen in time to come. How are we going to think about 9/11 in the future? And that's now nearly 10 years ago. How does it change religious involvement in global politics? Well, I'm afraid it's only to the bad. It's only to the bad. 9/11 will also be seen, I think, as an epochal event of wholly negative proportions. I mean, this is not anything you won't have thought yourself, I'm sure, but since 9/11, there's been increasing religious involvement in so-called inter-civilizational conflicts. It's a very slippery slope because 9/11 became this symbolic event of gross magnitude, great magnitude, which has led in some quarters to a sense that the post-9/11 era is one of pitting people against people, not necessarily through religious difference, but religion becomes a symbol of those differences. Protests and increased tension between the Muslim world and the West following 9/11, which, as you know, was itself followed by the invasion of Afghanistan in 2001, invasion of Iraq in 2003, and what we in Europe know as the Mohammed cartoons in 2005, when some wholly insulting cartoons of the Prophet Mohammed were published in Denmark's biggest newspaper. It's the continuing impact of Israel and the Palestinians' conflict and the perceived Western support for Israel, flexing of muscles of Shiite Iran and Shiite majority Iraq and in Lebanon, where Shiite Hezbollah is influential. Ahmadinejad was just in Lebanon yesterday, and the tens of thousands of people that met him on the streets were waving Iranian flags, which seems to me to be directly linked to how the world has changed since 9/11, and a direct link to how there's a polarization in international politics, in global politics, as a result of 9/11, which, in a sense, if we see this in terms of stages, leads, I think, to a whole new stage of seeing religion in global politics. Now, this is not to say, and I hope you're not getting the impression I'm suggesting, that this simply emphasizes religion's predilection for conflict, because I'm certainly not doing that. But it does emphasize to many people that many of the world's major conflicts do have a religious component. Why is that a problem? It's a problem because it makes tolerance, cooperation, peace much more harder to achieve. And it shows how religious concerns overlap with secular power-related concerns. These particular issues I'm referring to here, none of them have anything to do explicitly or solely with religion, but religion is a very important component in how people judge them. And it for me at least, 9/11 has led to a terrible outcome which will make the task of religious people to find a way towards cooperation and tolerance much more difficult to achieve. Now, this is produced by a friend of mine, Professor Jonathan Fox of Bar-Ilan University of Israel. He has a very major and important study of conflict, religion and state conflict. And this is his graph, which I've shamelessly stolen from him. He won't mind. The pink bit of the graph shows what he calls religious identity conflict. It's conflicts which he's coded, which have a profound religious component. So you can see that we've got, since 2006, we've got, let's say, a gradual rise, a peak in the mid-90s, a gradual rise in what he calls religious identity conflicts. There's a category which emerges in the mid-70s, or re-emerges in the mid-70s, which he calls religious war. This is the pale blue conflict. And he codes conflicts as wars, when there's a certain number of casualties involved. And he's showing on the graph that once again there's a peak in the mid-90s, a gradual decline, but still a high number of conflicts, 15 conflicts a year by the mid-2000s. And the conflicts which he says are not religious is the black line, the uncoloured black line. And you'll see that one characteristic of this graph is that there's many conflicts in the mid-90s, whether they be religious linked or not. The non-religious conflicts peak in about 1990. Am I in your way? Peak in about 1990 and gradually decline from something like 20 to 25 a year down to about 5 or so. The religious conflicts don't decline in the same way. And this is pretty graphic evidence that conflicts which can be legitimately coded as religious have a greater presence in international relations or global politics than do non-religious conflicts. It depends how we do the coding. I don't necessarily agree with how he codes, but there's a plausible picture that emerges, that religion is involved in conflicts in ways which it wasn't in the past. And this is pretty graphic evidence, because he produces some good data which is defensible. So it seems to be clear that when we think about conflicts in global politics, religion is a major component which isn't going away. The data only goes up to 2006, but there's been no dramatic change in those 3 or 4 years since then. So how do we explain this? Well, intergroup conflicts are sometimes explicitly framed in religious terms, and I'm suggesting they may be encouraged by globalisation. Why? Because the negative effects of globalisation can encourage people to not look for conflicts, not seek conflicts, but can encourage them to look to their own communities for stability and security. And that can lead to antagonism towards other communities. In situations of shortages of jobs, shortages of land, shortages of other material goods, it may be the case that people will look to their own people for help and begin to increase antagonism towards others. Once again, it's not simply that globalization has done this. There's not some sort of ratcheting cause and effect mechanism. But there does seem to be fairly good evidence that globalization produces circumstances of negativity to which some people respond by an inclusivization of their own concerns within their own communities. So this is because increased interaction between people and communities leads to encounters between different religious traditions which are not always harmonious. But, and it's quite a big but really, religion is a characteristic of antagonism, not necessarily the cause of antagonism. I think that most of the time antagonism is about material issues. It's about jobs, it's about homes, it's about the things we all need and value, and which are often in short supply, especially in the developing world. And religion can be a kind of a badge of identity which helps people define who they are in relation to others, and this can lead to conflict, or can reignite conflict, because religious conflicts very often have very deep roots. Conflicts between different groups characterised by their religion, or indeed their ethnicity, the two often overlap, very often have very deep historical roots. So religious worldviews can encourage different allegiances and standards in relation to various fundamental areas, including the state, land and politics, as for example in relation to Israel-Palestine. I mean, there's a whole lecture on that topic, and I won't go down that road, but it's certainly an example of how religion can be a symbol of much wider and deeper differences than simply differences in religious faith. And such conflicts may take on larger than life proportions, struggle for good against evil. Just almost at the end, but just to emphasise that religion and conflict, there's plenty of evidence for it. The recent religious involvement in political conflicts highlights religion's ambivalence. Much contemporary political violence in the Middle East, Africa, Asia, other parts of the developing world is associated with religious tensions, competition, and conflict. But I would like to emphasize once again that religion is more of a symbol of other differences. And very often these have material roots rather than simply roots in different faith worldviews. Then religious tensions are often linked to non-religious issues, including ethnicity, culture, class, power, and wealth. Very secular, very traditional forms of conflict. Religion gets included and can sometimes be preeminent in those older, more traditional conflicts. Why religion has assumed this role, it's really not clear. But once again, the evidence seems to suggest that religion increasingly is a way of defining difference in ways that it wasn't in the past. These tensions can be played out both within countries, Nigeria, Fiji, Cyprus, and Sri Lanka, to use but four examples, or between them, India, Pakistan, Israel, Palestine, Iraq, and Iran. Not religion which defines the difference, but religion which becomes a symbol of that difference. So I return to this notion of the ambivalence of the sacred. And this is not my phrase. It's linked to the historian R. Scott Appleby, who published a book in 2001 with that very title, The Ambivalence of the Sacred. And it highlights, in my view, very, very succinctly how religion has attributes within it which can lead both to cooperation and conflict. Once again, I don't want to emphasize the conflict. I would like to emphasize the cooperation. But I do think that it's very difficult to make cooperation work in a context where conflict can very easily break out. We can have very many meetings of well-meaning people over difference, and we can reach agreement that difference is not desirable. It just takes one person with the means and ability to exercise extreme violence, and it's very hard to rebuild trust. So it's a way of saying, I think, that conflict is much, much more instrumental in relationships between different religious groups than cooperation often is, because conflict has the ability to destroy trust and breed intolerance. So religious and faith communities can also be effective as angels of peace. This is certainly the case, and I wouldn't want you to think that I'm dismissing or undermining this. They certainly have the ability to be effective progenitors of cooperation, peace. And as I mentioned, this duality is what the Notre Dame historian R. Scott Appleby refers to as the ambivalence of the sacred. It underlines that ultimately the relationship of religions to violence is unclear. Maybe not so much unclear as literally ambivalent. It can be one thing or the other. This is because they often evolve from traditions that in certain circumstances legitimize force, may claim victims in the battle for their own beliefs, and may demonize believers in other religions. Religion is this very ambivalent thing that can have different aspects and different characteristics at different times. No religion is one thing or the other, it seems. So to conclude, so religion as a civilizing factor, and I would want to end on an optimistic note. Simultaneously, religions often also provide sources that proclaim the incompatibility of violence with religious tenets, as I mentioned earlier, expecting sacrifices for peace and respect for people of other religions. This is absolutely the case. But if we are to assume that for the foreseeable future the religions of the world will continue to be a factor in political conflicts, then it's high time that we seek to strengthen the civilizing side of the sacred, making it more difficult to be taken over by interests with other, much less desirable goals. That's easy for me to say, very difficult to achieve, I think. So just two pages of conclusions then. So globalization, I'm suggesting, involves thrusting religions into new global contexts, issues, and controversies. As a result, religions can no longer isolate themselves and must often deal with a range of socio-political issues. Religion affects global politics in many ways, both good and bad. On the one hand, religious terrorism. On the other hand, clear signs of cooperation to seek to achieve normatively desirable goals. Lots of inter-religious dialogue about human rights, lots of inter-religious dialogue about environmental issues. So lots of good work going on. In short, globalization affects religion's socio-political involvement in various ways, necessarily towards improved human rights. I'm not sure what I mean by that. Just erase the words after ways from your memory, and I'll move swiftly on. I don't know what I'm thinking of there. Religion can play a significant role in attempts to resolve inter- and intergroup clashes and help build peace. All religious traditions contain references in the form of didactical stories, teaching, or even direct recommendations as to how the faithful should act in order to achieve harmony and peace within him, herself in the first place. Therefore, religious leaders are uniquely positioned to foster non-violent conflict transformation through the building of constructive, collaborative relationships within and across religious groups for the common good. The problem with that final comment, however, is that things don't stay the same. Things don't stay static. And the circumstances of globalization means that the ground is constantly shifting beneath the feet of religious leaders and their desire for cooperation and harmony. And on that note, I shall stop. Thank you very much for your attention.
I would
be shocked if there weren't any. Shocked and horrified.
Fifth session to ask a question, but I wanted to, if I may, to pick you up on what you said about 9/11 as being completely negative. And I wondered whether that comment was in some sense couched within a political frame of reference, because it seemed to me that while it was entirely a dreadful business, and you know, for those who suffered, and for the obvious political consequences of it, and global tensions, and so on, one thing that might be said in its favor is that it perhaps wakened us, or out of our enlightenment slumbers, to paraphrase Kant, perhaps in reverse. What do you think about that?
I think, you know, we were awakened from our enlightenment slumbers long before that, really. Certainly, the United States from the 1970s, the Muslim world from the same period. I think we'd more or less seen the back of the idea that there was one rational scientific future that religion only played a small role in. And the reason that I call 9/11 wholly negative is that it's made, in my view, intolerance respectable. It's made tolerance very, very difficult to achieve. And it's made the sense that rational dialogue can produce compromises and pragmatic outcomes we can all live with almost impossible to deliver. So I think 9/11 is expressly a source of pessimism, and one which will be impossible to eradicate any time soon. And I'm saying this, I think, because it seems to have kick-started an endless cycle of recriminations and increasingly polarised and already polarising world.
Good evening.
Hello.
Thank you. You've imparted a lot of interesting thoughts. My name is Rana Al-Rabi, and it's funny you mentioned soft power, and that really attracted my attention since I specialize in public relations.
Okay.
So I'm all about influencing. And there are three things, if I may. The first one is, you know, we're talking about religion, world religions and global politics. How do you feel about colonization as being the root of today's conflicts?
I don't think it is. I think that it's impossible to redo time again. It's impossible to go back and start from, you know, a kind of a Rawlsian's ideal society. So I think that we can certainly trace tensions, conflicts, and so on to colonization. But I think that to, if you like, blame colonization for everything forever won't get us very far. Because even if we say, okay, it's all to do with colonization, we still have to take the next step is how to resolve that problem.
Right. It just seems like the aftermath of colonization is so deep-rooted that the societies that were oppressed are not able to be functional. I mean, we can see the so-called developing world, which was colonized, and it seems like it can't stand up on its feet. So I just wanted to get your impression.
I think there's a diversity, isn't there? There, for every failing state, there are countries doing very well that were also colonies. I mean, I'm not here to defend colonialism or colonization at all, but I think it's probably making a sort of a scapegoat for something which was much more nuanced than simply negative.
Okay. The other two things I have are more of personal thoughts. I just feel that as a Muslim, I'm very uncomfortable by the frequent mention of the term Al-Qaeda, because to me, this is a mysterious group that is CIA constructed and that has a political agenda. And I don't know how many Muslims agree with their actions, but it just seems like they seem to be mentioned often.
The reason that I use Al-Qaeda as an example of religious soft power is that in a declining way, but still significant way, the ideas and goals it pursues do find favour amongst sections of Muslim publics, for better or for worse. People, Muslims and everybody else, find extremism abhorrent most of the time. But Al-Qaeda tends to undermine its own position by using extremism. But the ideas that Al-Qaeda puts forward, which is of a global environment under heavy Western suzerainty of a very negative kind for Muslims, goes down very well amongst many Muslims. So that's why I use Al-Qaeda, not as a kind of an example of a popular Muslim group, but as an example of a group which has support because of the ideas it expresses, that undermines that support by its tactics.
Right, the political ideas that they express.
Well, I mean, they would call them religious ideas, actually. I would agree with you that they're wholly political, but Al-Qaeda comes from a very clear religious background.
Yeah, no, because what they promote has nothing to do with the teachings or beliefs of Islam, so I just wanted to clarify that. And the third thing is, you mentioned Palestine, Israel a few times, and I feel that it's a delicate issue, and I feel it's important to clarify that the tension that we see there has nothing to do with religion. It's more, as you said, of a territorial fight. And you have the deep imbalance between the Israeli state and the indigenous Palestinian people. And I actually think that it is the faiths coming together that can create a solution there and elsewhere. Because that cooperation already exists. I can see it, and it's present here and there. So, again, I feel that it's strictly a political problem.
Okay, well, the reason I mentioned Palestinians, Israel, just briefly, is because it's a conflict which has assumed religious characteristics, whereas it didn't have them in the past. It used to be a very clear-cut secular nationalist issue. Which people, which nation would inhabit the land? And the Palestinians, led by Fatah, Yasser Arafat's Fatah, was a secular nationalist group. Israel at the time was Zionism, as you know, is a secular nationalist ideology, ideal. But what's occurred in recent times is that Israel has become more heavily affected by religious ideas that justify its occupation of land. It justifies the occupation of Jerusalem, for example, which the Palestinians also claim as a holy city for Muslims. So that's why I would include it in a list of conflicts which have religious connotations. But I think I was careful to say that conflicts that have religious connotations usually reflect other more material conflicts too. But I use it as an example because it's something which has occurred in recent years, a conflict which has acquired religious characteristics in recent years, which, in my estimation, it didn't have in the past.
Thank you for your thoughts.
Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Haynes.
You're welcome.
When you were talking about the unsecularization of society, I don't see it in Quebec. And maybe in France, I don't see it either. I don't know what's happening so much in England. But what I do see, we call more recent immigrants to Quebec or Canada new Canadians. I guess that makes me an old Canadian. But what I see is the establishment, political establishment, particularly in Quebec, and I follow a little bit what's going on in France, declaring vehemently that we are a secular state, la laïcité, which is untranslatable, but a lay state, and in France also with Sarkozy. But then new Canadians and maybe new Europeans have required that this vehement secular position engage in dialogue in how to accommodate. No. My question is, will it last? Because will Muslims in France become secularized as generations go on? But I don't see the unsecularization of Western Europe and of Quebec. Western Canada is more conservative, but I see new Canadians or immigrants bringing that issue. But it's ambivalent also. In Quebec, if you touch the cross on the mountain or you take out the crucifix of the National Assembly, there'll be a riot. But people don't go to church and generally are not terribly public about their religion. So it seems there are two groups that are in this issue.
Okay. Well, normally when I refer to that phrase, the unsecularization of the world, it's in a kind of it's in a questioning way. Whereas this evening I referred to it, I guess, as a fact. Once again, this is down to what evidence do we have? You're right. No trend is ever global. But if a trend is 80% global, does it make it universal? In a sense, it does. There's also some controversy about whether Europe is as secular as it used to be. And it's not just about what you call in Quebec new Canadians, or we might call in Europe new Europeans. It's the fact that whereas Western Europe has a context of secularization in the public sphere, and you mentioned France, people's belief in God and belief in spiritual issues more generally hasn't declined. And the English sociologist Grace Davey has referred to it as believing without belonging. So even in Western Europe, the argument could be made, the argument is made, that there is not an overt reversal of secularization, but there isn't clear evidence of the continuation or continuous development of secularization. But where Western Europe differs from many other parts of the world is the decline of traditional expressions of organized religion. There's also the rise of many what we'd call New Age religions and the rise of a kind of eclectic spiritualism in Europe. And I think that when George Weigel talks about an unsecularization of the world, he's including within it this sense of spiritual questing, which is the case in Europe. Now, I don't know enough about Quebec or indeed Canada to comment usefully about that place and that context, but I think that it's a strongly argued position that there is something called an unsecularization of the world. And perhaps most importantly, I don't know. Perhaps most importantly, many people implicitly or explicitly accept that as happening. But I'm sure you're right. I mean, we could find many countries that if we looked into the evidence, we wouldn't be able to say, yes, there is definitely a kind of a religious resurgence or rise. But it would be quite hard probably to find clear, unequivocal signs of a decline of spirituality. Now, I'm well aware that spirituality and religious faith are not the same thing. But I think that Weigel is talking about spirituality and other forms of religious belief all lumped together.
I found your talk very interesting, but by the time I leave this place, I'll probably forget everything you said. Can we have a handout of your thoughts, if possible?
I have with me, not a handout, something better than that. I have my business card.
Okay.
And anyone that would like a copy of the talk will be repaid with a copy of the talk if you email me. Simple as that.
That's one thing. And secondly, you talk about Pope John Paul bringing down the wall in a way.
Yes.
How, in practical terms, did it happen? The fact that the Polish became very nationalistic and religion spread throughout Poland. How, in practical terms, did it bring down the...
Well, you know, religion never unspread throughout Poland. The state repressed religion, and one of the, or if not the only space that was free for non-controlled talk were the churches. So I think that the Catholicism, I mean, you're right in a way, to differentiate Catholicism from Polishness, it's very difficult. 95% of Poles profess to be Catholics. But I think that what gave them the impetus to demand change was the visit of the Pope. And he was able to express very cleverly, express ideas of human rights, actually. He was talking about human rights rather than religion. But the Poles got the idea that the most important human right they could imagine was the free expression of Catholicism. But of course, the Berlin Wall came down in 1989. It wasn't a wall in Poland that came down. East Germany was one of the most secular places on earth when that wall came down. So I'm not suggesting that religion led to the collapse of the Soviet Union directly. But what began in Poland, for me, a very clear expression of a desire for a repositioning of religion in people's lives and in the role of the state, became accepted elsewhere in the communist Eastern Europe as an expression of a demand for change. And the crucial thing was, I think, that when neither the Polish government nor the Soviet Union used force to crush that, others gained heart and thought, hey, we might be onto something here. So I think religion started a snowball. But I would agree with you that it's not only about religion, and that nationalistic concerns also had a very important role to play.
Yeah. One of the things with the sort of specificity of the rise of religion as a sort of a focus of international tension, because, I mean, you think about the post-war period, we had, you know, the Cold War with the Soviet bloc in the West, and that was sort of the defining feature of international conflict. And so not even post 9/11, but even before that, there was a growing sense that after that chapter was closed, the new chapter had something to do with religion and conflict. But there is a specificity to it in the sense that the conflict was defined around this kind of Islam and the West. So it wasn't just religion and conflict. I think it had a certain specificity to it that was kind of crystallized in a stronger way with 9/11. It was right after 9/11, Bush published the National Security Document. And when I first read that document, the buzzword there is terrorism, and U.S.'s national security interests have to be have to be dealt with in terms of this confrontation with terrorism. And I did a word, find and replace, and I replaced terrorism with communism.
Oh, yeah.
It read like a 1950s Cold War document.
It was written by people with the same ideological worldview.
But the thing that was interesting was the frame of reference clearly was there in terms of the sense of the tension between Islam and the West, and the Islam and U.S. national security. But there's something there, and obviously I think there's a lot of uncomfortability with the kind of clash of civilizations discourse that Huntington puts forward. It somehow doesn't get it right. I mean, it seems to be an ideologically loaded approach. But nevertheless, there does seem to be some serious way of framing this new sense of the role of religion in international conflict, that somehow we need to get the specificity of this tension with Islam. Remember, one of your pieces speaks about the BJP, and within that frame of reference, there's this discourse on the access of virtue, which includes Hindu right, Jewish right, Christian right, lined up against who? Well, it's Islamic resurgence. I don't know how we speak to that effectively within the academy. We tend to sort of not want to speak about that specificity and find another language to get at it, but somehow I think we need to find some kind of way of getting at the specificity of these tensions around Islam. I mean, from one perspective, it can be just viewed and dismissed to some extent as the problem is the West's response, or the problem is Islam's response to the West. And we need another frame to be able to talk about this. I don't know if you have any.
Okay. Well, I have to confess that many examples, and I take the point from the earlier question, many examples would do with Islam, but there's also a bigger issue here with religion is involved, and it's something which implicitly Bush is talking about in 2002, and that is the norms and values expressed by some religious traditions. It's not Islam alone, it's traditionalist views from a range of religions about role of women in society, the position of individualistic human rights, the position of the family. There is almost like a coalition of religious traditionalists which have an important and growing role in global politics. So I think that if we wanted to broaden out, and I agree with you that to concentrate on sort of a Huntingtonian clash of civilizations doesn't get us very far. But I don't think that's the whole story. When Bush and Huntington are talking about clash of civilizations, what they're talking about at root is a clash of values. They're talking about worldviews which are, in their view, incompatible. And it would be possible, I think, to make the argument that there is a religious worldview which incorporates a number of religious traditions which have a great problem with a liberal worldview. And that doesn't necessarily mean a liberal secular worldview, but a liberal worldview where individual rights are preeminent over collective rights. So to broaden this out and take it away from the focus on conflict in Islam, it would be possible to bring religion into the frame as an inter-religious component of a human rights dialogue. And groups I'm calling rather generally and egregiously anti-individualistic groups do have a powerful ability to influence outcomes. So I suppose it would be possible to develop the argument that it's a conflict which is not only about tiny groups of extremists and Western governments, but a much wider issue which could broadly be labelled human rights, and what human rights, what are the sources of human rights, where does religion fit into a liberal worldview that is very much pointing towards human rights which are individually based rather than collectively based. And if there is this inter-religious worldview on human rights, it would be that collective rights are being overlooked and individualistic rights are being highlighted too much. So that would be a basis of a wider picture. I haven't developed it, as you can hear, but it certainly would be something which could be developed.
Professor Haynes, for your splendid presentation, the clarity with which you have set our agenda. And if I could just make an announcement, the conversation needn't stop. We have a reception downstairs waiting for you. There's wine and cheese and soft drinks as well, and I hope you'll join us for a libation. And please join with me in thanking Professor Haynes for coming all the way from London to give us this wonderful talk.
Thank you. And if anyone would like to take one of my cards and email me and say, email me the PowerPoint, please, I'll be happy to do so. You're welcome.